You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network.
Ah, shit.
What?
Well, Don Avalon would have nailed this opening. I got nothing. Ooh, nailed the opening. Audio wink. Nailed it. Don Avalon style. Old style. Old dudes. Yeah. Music.
Thou art to be hanged, then burnt over a basket of living cats.
Welcome to New World Pictures Podcast. We're going to talk about every movie released by New World Pictures. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
I don't think we need miniseries anymore.
And we have so many left. And Erica.
Please, I go by Don Avalon now.
And we are coming to the end of November.
I think it was meant to be November.
Oh, really? Oh, I thought it was November.
You're right, Erica. Actually, you're right.
Yes, Erica. I think you are right, Erica. This is a month where we are discussing movies that we previously said no to, and this movie in particular. I remember I said no to, because back in April when we were doing April sweeps, we found out that this movie existed, and I said, no, we're not doing a miniseries on top of everything else we're doing. No way. Instead, we did it here in November. And of course, we're talking about 1987's Queenie.
India, a land of majestic wonders. Hidden mysteries, exotic traditions, where an ancient world coexisted with a modern empire, and the child they called Queenie could never belong.
I'm sorry, my dear. I'm afraid you have to leave. You know the rules. Whites only.
They know about me.
What do they know?
That I'm part black.
She grew more captivating with every passing year, enchanting, alluring, sensual. The years now hold secrets that must not be shared, and a destiny that must be escaped.
I can't leave you here.
It's your only chance.
Oh, no, no, you need it.
Go. Make the most of yourself, Queenie. Do it for me.
Across the ocean she traveled to escape a past she couldn't forget and find a future she never imagined.
You ever done any acting?
Her beauty would enrapture many.
I want to change my life. I want you to be my agent.
Her determination would bring her everything she desired most. Power, wealth, fame. The world would know her as one of the most celebrated stars of Hollywood's golden era. But only a very special few would know her as Queenie. Starring Martin Balsam, Kirk Douglas, Joel Grey, Sarah Miles, Topol, and Mia Sara as Queenie.
That's right, 1987's Queenie, brought to you by Hat Nets. Nothing helps you stay conspicuous than hat netting. Sure, flies are an issue when you're riding a horse, but if you need to keep your identity a closely kept secret, nothing works better than hat netting. Say goodbye to insects and hello to anonymity with hat nets. Love it.
I don't think it works that well. I think it works better with the flies.
I don't know. This is directed by Larry Pierce, who floated between TV and movies through most of his career, dating back to his theatrical debut, 1964's One Potato, Two Potato, and then directing episodes of Branded and the original Batman TV series. Then getting back into features like Ash Wednesday from 1972, 1973's A Separate Piece, 1975's The Other Side of the Mountain, and 1988's Wired. A lot of adaptations.
I can confidently say that I have not seen any of those movies.
I have seen A Separate Piece because we read A Separate Piece when I was in 10th grade. We had to do that for English class. So I've seen A Separate Piece. And I saw Wired. So that was, of course, based on the bio.
Shit on my point. That's John fine. Belushi. No problem.
Well, I'm not shitting on your point that you haven't seen them. That's your point is still very valid. I have seen them. If your point had been one's ever seen those movies, I would. Now I'm shitting on your point because I have seen a couple of them, but that wasn't your point. The point was that you haven't seen them.
That's fair.
And you're
that's
still fair. Right.
By saying that, I kind of shit on your point. So
thanks for asking, guys. I've never seen them.
He also continued to work in TV, where he directed several miniseries, such as the third installment of the North and South series of miniseries, and also this. He also directed the 1988 TV movie Elvis and Me for New World Television. So,
this isn't the last we're going to hear about him.
Elvis and Me.
Oh, it looks like we're ready for next November. We're already got the lineup. Oops, spoiler, everybody. We just announced our November 2025 schedule.
Yep. This is written by April Smith. She was a TV writer who had written for Lou Grant and Cagney and Lacey in a 1984 TV movie biopic about Ernie Kovacs. I think, and I'm not 100%, but I believe she rewrote the initial draft, which was written by playwright James Goldman, who also wrote the films The Lion in Winter and Robin and Marion. But here he is credited as Winston Beard because he was like, don't put that Queenie on my resume, I guess.
Winston Beard?
Winston
that sounds
Beard.
Like a name that a kid, if you were like, hey, think of a new name, a kid's just looking around the room like, Winston Beard. Like, I would just be like, Erica Glasses. I guess I'll go by Mark Hoodie. Yes.
Not unlike the name Don Avalon in that regard. This movie is based on a 1985 best-selling book called Queenie, which is published by Simon & Schuster, where its author, Michael Korda, worked as an editor for a very long time. The book was based on the life of actress Meryl Oberon, who appeared in movies like 1939's Wuthering Heights. And
is it Withering or Wuthering Heights?
It's Bulova. Bulova. Bologna.
Oh, I forgot about that bit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Also, 1933's The Private Life of Henry VIII.
Sounds riveting.
If you thought his public life was crazy, wait till you hear his private life. It's nuts.
The latter of which, that last movie that it was so exciting, was produced by Alexander Korda, who was Michael's uncle, who was married to Meryl Oberon. And the book was not written as a biography, but a novel, a genre that I learned because of this. I learned is referred to as roman à clé, or you might.
And the point of this story is.
Oh, yes. As we might say, roman à clef, where it is about real people and events, but their names are changed. There's a key to changing and unlocking the truths behind it, but it's mostly all made up. Michael Korda said this in May of 1986 about his book. He said, I wanted to write a bio of Meryl, but I realized that making her story up made for better reading. That's what he said about this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If someone were to write a book about me, I hope they write a novelized version. It'll be much more interesting than the actual story of
that's
me.
That's right.
Oh, hell yeah. You better make my story real exciting because actually, you know what? I'm pretty exciting. Maybe I take that all back. You need to make my story tame because if you tell the real story, listeners, you're not ready for it.
Too hot for all readers.
Too hot. It is steaming hot.
Ooh.
Nobody's ready for it.
Ooh, we're going to get to steaming. Don't you worry about that. This one
you're
going to
hear about it all on my spinoff podcast called My Fake Cast, where I just talk about my fake life. And I make up all the sensational things that I do.
Hosted by Erica Glasses.
That's right. Your host, Erica Glasses.
This movie stars Mia Sara as Queenie Kelly, a.k.a. Dawn Avalon. Sara was a breakout star at the moment. She had appeared in Ridley Scott's Legend and Ferris Bueller's mm-hmm. Day Off. And she was cast while she was shooting Apprentice to Murder, released by New World Pictures in 1988. Mm-hmm. In fact, she began shooting Queenie in London the day after returning from Norway, where she had been shooting Apprentice to Murder. So from one right into the other. Dang. Sara admitted in...
To be young again. They're like,
right,
hey,
right.
After you wrap up this thing in Norway, you got to go to England and start on this other movie. I'd be like, fuck that.
And I'm like, not without a couple weeks in the middle there.
Yeah. Daddy needs time to sit and catch up on all those Vinegar Syndrome movies that have been delivered to my house.
Right, that I need to watch. Don't worry, it did catch up to Sara, Mia Sara, and we'll explain as we get into it that it did catch up to her. But anyway, she admitted in 1987 that she had not read the book.
That makes two of us. Don't worry, girl. I didn't read the book either.
The three of us did not read the book, and Mark might even say no one has read the book.
Well, I thought Ryan was going to jump in with, I read the book, and I listened to the book's director's commentary, and I have the Blu-ray of the book, and the book's writer's commentary.
The book's director's commentary. Now, that is something that we need in the world. I wrote a book, but I also have a full book-length commentary I want to say about the book.
Just you flipping pages on screen and just talking about what you were thinking when you wrote each and every page.
Oh, I remember this one. I had just had a great breakfast when I wrote this particular part.
Funny story. The ribbon on my typewriter went out when I was typing this page and I had to go down to
Staples. I wrote this in 1984. That's how old this book is. All right. She said that she had not read the book, but she prepped by watching Wuthering Heights, not mm-hmm, Withering, mm-hmm. Wuthering Heights 13 times.
Why?
To watch the performance of Merle Oberon, who was in the movie.
Gosh. Okay.
And it should be noted, and we will be saying this a lot in this episode, but Mia Sara is not of East Indian descent.
No,
not at all. Sara, who was 19 at the time of filming, comes from an Italian family. However, she admitted that she did not look like Merle Oberon, but said this to the LA Times in December of 1986. She said, quote, since I've been cast in the film, I've been looking in the mirror and thinking maybe I do look a bit Indian, particularly around the eyes.
Oh, I bet she regrets saying that.
And now you know why I mentioned previously that she was 19.
Yeah, exactly. That's what a 19-year-old says.
Yeah, 19 is like, I don't know, maybe I'm going to look a little Indian. Like, no, you don't.
Right.
But there's other parts of the of people that do not have East Indian ancestry that gets very problematic to say.
Well,
less,
I mean, but Ryan, this was during a time, like, think about it. This is 1984. There were no. Oh, this was 1987. Mm-hmm. Even worse in 87. I mean, listeners, I know a lot of you don't remember 1987. Maybe you're too young. Those of you who are old enough do remember. There were no Indian actors then.
None. There was just none.
There was none.
They didn't exist.
You had to do with what you had. And that's what this movie did.
The only working Indian actor was the guy who played the chief of police in India in this movie.
I don't even believe that.
That's the only real guy. That was it. He was the sole actor.
No, he was the chief of police.
He was.
He just happened to have some semi-decent acting chops.
The only theater they could watch were solo shows from this guy. Mia Sarah was not the only actress that was up for the part. In fact, initially, Michael Korda mentioned that he wanted Jane Seymour for this part, saying in June of 1985, he said, "We haven't talked casting at all yet, but to my mind, Jane Seymour is absolutely perfect for the part." Now, that's 1985. When we get to 1986, and we're actually getting closer to production, Natasha Kinski and Helena Bonham Carter were also possibilities. We're not getting any nearer to anyone with actually any Indian.
I would argue we're stepping further away with Natasha Kinski on that one.
I mean, Bonham Carter, who had just made her debut, or, I mean, she had been in another movie, but she made her big lead role debut in A Room with a View, was Korda's top choice in 1986. And he told the Birmingham Mail that my own choice is Helena Bonham Carter. I think she is just made for the part. Tawny Welch is also high on my list. That's Raquel's daughter. Of course, Natasha Kinski is high on the studio's list, but she strikes me as a little out of it.
Whoa.
No, yikes. Jane Seymour, I think, is splendidly English, high cheekbone, and marvelous, but sadly, perhaps a little too old for now. A little too old now. For all that, I'm a bit torn about her. For the record, Bonham Carter would appear in a TV movie in 1987. It's called A Wizard of Hearts, and it debuted in December of 1987 on CBS. So she still was on her TVs at that time.
Wasn't that also the name of a Juice Newton song?
Hazard of Hearts.
Oh, no. Sorry, that was the Queen of Hearts. Never mind. Move on. Okay. Sorry about that.
I don't know if she was also in a movie called Betty Davis Eyes. Wasn't that
playing
was
with
that
the Queen of Hearts? That was Kim Carnes. Come on, Ryan.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you for that. All right. This also stars Kirk Douglas as filmmaker David Koenig, aka film producer Alexander Korda. Who, of course, is the uncle of the author of the book. Douglas had recently appeared in 1986's Tough Guys with Burt Lancaster, but he had made a few TV movies in the 1980s, and Korda was familiar with Douglas. In fact, he said in an article that his mother, Gertrude Musgrove Korda, acted in a play in 1942 with Ruth Gordon, Catherine Cornell, and Judith Anderson. An assistant stage manager on the play I got to know was Isser Yankel Dembski, which is the real name of Kirk Douglas. Douglas turned 70 during production, and 9 years later, that's when he would suffer that stroke that would basically limit his speech. Where you can watch Queenie, you can watch it on our YouTube channel. We have it up. It is in two parts from a VHS rip, but there's also a rip on YouTube as well that's not ours, where you can watch it, and it's all edited together if you'd like to watch all nearly 4 hours of it. So it's up to you.
There was a time when I was young.
what?
Miniseries were quite popular on television back in the 80s. And I always thought, I didn't watch a lot of miniseries, but the Gambler was a big one. The Thornbirds was a huge one. And sure. I remember V was originally a miniseries.
Sure.
And I thought that the reason why you made a miniseries was because you had so much content that you simply couldn't pack it in to an hour and a half or 2 hours. But after watching this, I realized that that's not the case. That you're really just trying to stretch that content as long as you can to fill 2 hours. Because I really believe with some snappy editing, this could be an hour 40 and you'd get it. You wouldn't be missing anything.
Well, I mean, the previous miniseries that we had did, of course, why we said no to this one is we did a miniseries in April Sweeps. We did Tom Clancy's Op Center, which was aired over two nights. But when it was released on video, unlike this one, which has two tapes, they had edited it down to just under 2 hours. So it's possible they just didn't do it with this one.
I know we're not at final questions, but as far as our recent forays into miniseries, mm-hmm. did you feel that this Queenie was longer than RoboCop the series?
No, but I know what you're saying. It definitely was long. I mean, to be honest, at this point, when I watch like modern movies, which are like 2.5 to 3 hours long, they're like little miniseries to me because I'm like, well, that's not going to happen in a night. That's going to happen have to happen over several nights. You know, it's too long.
How about you, Erica?
The RoboCop series felt like it was just the same episode over and over and over again. So mm-hmm, it was a little mm-hmm. tedious to watch. Mm-hmm. With Queenie, it was like, I knew it was going to be boring. So I was like, okay. So I was almost pleasantly surprised when it wasn't. Like the Fair. Beginning of it and everything that's in India and all that is like very beautiful and very interesting. And I know we're not at, you know, final questions, but I think that... it just sort of starts to drag out in that second tape or mm-hmm. the second volume mm-hmm. or the second half, whatever you want to call it. And I think in ways that I wasn't prepared for, I thought, right. Oh, they're going to just, you know, have more scenes or whatever, but it was like, oh no, you're going to sit and just actually watch some of this movie being shot. Some of Don For Avalon's, sure. But it was like, oh, well, all right. Okay. But you're never going to see the whole thing, but you're going to see a lot of it. So right. I don't know. I think they were both tough to watch in different ways, but at the end of it, I'm not going to lie. I came out liking Queenie. I was a fan. Mm-hmm. I'll save what I hated for things we love, things we hated. But I came out of it being like, all right, well, if that was a Lifetime movie, I'm in.
And it does have a Lifetime quality. Speaking of that, though, before we go any further, we need to talk about what this movie is about. Mark, what is Queenie about?
A director, down on his luck, lacking motivation to make a film again, finds motivation when he meets the talented, beautiful Don Avalon and proceeds to write a script, raise $25 million, hire a film crew, travel to India, all in the hopes of getting her in bed.
Yeah.
Now, that was my second take on this. My first one was a young Indian girl gets her chance to go to England and explore her fetish of ostrich feathers. But either one, I think, works.
Yeah. Erica, what is this movie about?
For me, it was pretty simple. It was really eye-opening because it was just shocking to see that sometimes it's hard for even beautiful people to get jobs. So I really, I couldn't believe it. At first, I was like, is this feels too fantastic because someone this beautiful should just easily get a job. So it was really kind of like, wow, to see, you know, like beautiful people. They're just like us, you know?
Yeah. I mean,
I'm not sure I'd get that. I'm not sure yeah. I'm with you on that last part, but okay.
I think for me, like this movie, like many other movies, when you play a horn instrument, life's going to be hard. Mm-hmm. You know, like that.
It's a woodwind. That's the life of a woodwind. It's not easy.
It is not going to be easy.
You know, I watched this movie over the last 2 days and I feel like I was on such a long journey. I kind of forgot about that character until you brought him up right now.
He's in it. He's in it a lot. Well, what isn't long is the Letterboxd synopsis. Now, we are on Letterboxd, so give us a follow there if you can. Letterboxd synopsis says this. A half-caste beauty emigrates from India to Great Britain. Half-caste, I guess, is an old way of saying she's of mixed race.
Mm-hmm. God, mm-hmm. Who wrote this letterbox? My great-grandma? Jesus.
Yeah. Emigrates from India to Great Britain, pursues fame and fortune at the cost of personal happiness, and becomes a Hollywood movie star while suppressing the truth of her heritage.
I mean, that's accurate.
Yeah. I mean,
your great-grandma wrote an accurate description of this movie.
She would have never said suppressed. I take it back.
But I would argue the cost of her personal happiness, I don't agree with, in that that's supposed to imply that because her boyfriend, that Kirk Douglas messes with that boyfriend that she has so that he can then make a play on her and she thinks he's given up on her. But she was seemingly perfectly happy in that relationship. So I don't feel like she was like, God, I got to get away from Kirk Douglas. The movie didn't at least make me think that. So I don't know if she gave up personal happiness. I don't know.
I mean, I think that she struggled between her aspirations for a movie career and being with the love of her life, quote unquote. But she seemed to still be okay in the end. Like, she didn't.
It was like, yeah, I mean, it seemed to work out. I mean, right. I mean, not to spoil the ending, but it all works out. But in any case, right. Let's start in the beginning, where we open the movie in 1931 in Calcutta, India. And indeed, the film was actually shot there. Not in Calcutta, but in other parts of India. Now, the real Queenie, Merle Oberon, kept her life very private, to the point where even Queenie author Michael Korda, who was her nephew, didn't know a ton about her background, which is why he wrote the book he wrote. Or, as he put it in May of 1987, he said, "It's strange because occasionally people ask, how can you invent something about the life of a real person? The thing about Merle Oberon is she totally invented her life to begin with. To get anywhere near the truth, you have to invent it."
I'm not sure it works that way.
Yeah, I don't know.
Anywhere near the truth, you have to invent it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
If any of our children say that, we should be very afraid.
Yeah, that's not how the truth is derived, but that's okay. But one thing we do know about Merle Oberon is that she did grow up in India and did attend a private school. And that is according to the authors of her actual biography, which is not what this movie's based on. In the miniseries, young Queenie, she's getting bullied at school, and she has to come home and talk about it with her mom.
It took you at St. Catherine's, knowing you were Anglo-Indian. I'm sure the girls will come round.
It's one thing to be English and another to be Indian. But nobody likes you when you're half and half.
Everybody likes you. You're a very beautiful girl.
Who am I, Mama? Who am I supposed to be?
You're my baby, and you're going to have a wonderful life.
When we go to England?
Yes, darling. When your daddy sends for us, we're going to England. We're going home.
When's that going to be?
When he's ready. It's very expensive, you know.
I hope he's ready soon.
He will be. We'll have a lovely house, and we'll all be together again.
Now, two things. One, the mom is telling her two lies. The first one being like, of course they all like you because you're so pretty. Nope. Incorrect. That's not how life works. Sorry. The second one, it's ultimately really hard to feel the impact of that scene considering Queenie's mother is played by English actress Claire Bloom, who played Hera in 1981's Clash of the Titans. I mean... So she's got a lot of makeup on to try to make her look like she's from India. And that's all right. But she's not the only one.
And the third tough thing about that scene is it's impossible to adjust the tracking any better on that audio.
It is So tough. I worked very hard with the tracking. This particular VHS set was real rough in the old tracking. Better in part two than part one. So that depends on the tape, I guess. Anyway, there are other people that are also playing characters from India that are not, and the actors are not. Her uncle Morgan, the musician and the primary breadwinner, I guess, for the family when they're in Calcutta. He's played by Lee Lawson, who had appeared in 1979's Tess with Natasha Kinski, who could have played, and they were like lovers in that movie, so that would have been interesting for this one. But anyway, he had also been in Cannon's 1984 film Sword of the Valiant. And then even her grandmother is played by an English actress. So all of her immediate family are not from
India. When there are no Indian actors, you have to make do with what you have.
Yeah,
there's none.
They traveled through India. We're like, I found no one. But at school, Queenie's being bullied by the young Prunella, a character that will somehow remain a constant adversary in her life, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. I know I got pushed around in school, but I haven't seen this people in forever. So I don't know. I mean, I have to hand it to Prunella. She is persistent. She's like, no, I have.
That's how Ryan lets us know he was good looking growing up. Bullied a lot. Hated. Clearly he was handsome. We get it, Ryan. We'll try to feel bad for you.
Meanwhile, so other things are also not going well for Queenie because she has a teacher who offers her diction lessons in private, of course.
How do private lessons, son? After school? The other girls need never know.
How much would they cost?
Please, you insult me. You and I are friends. There's no cost.
Well then. Thank you very much, sir.
And guess what? He turns out to be a creep. Who saw that coming? I mean, I didn't think that was ever.
Not Queenie.
When Queenie's grandmother decides to take her around to learn about her Indian heritage, a literal riot breaks out, ends with her grandmother getting killed and burned up in their house. So Queenie cannot catch a break here.
That's what happens when you skip school, kids.
That's right. When your grandmother comes around and says, come around with me, I want to show you some stuff. You go, no. No, I'm going to go to school.
No, I like Grandma, where I live. I want you to live.
Yeah, I want you around, Grandma. Things don't improve 5 years later when Mia Sara finally and literally enters the movie. And as it seems that almost Queenie's whole family, they want to destroy the Rumseys. as we see, Uncle Morgan is now spending his evenings after playing at the club with Mrs. Rumsey. Which comes to a head when Mr. Rumsey catches them in the act.
You are dead!
You have no right, Bertie.
You're nowhere in this club or anywhere else again. I'll destroy you.
Daddy, what's happening? Shall I call the police?
Stay out of this, Prunella. There will be no charges, will there, Bertie?
Charges.
Now, Mrs. Rumsey is played by Sarah Miles, who we might remember from Steaming.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, of course we remember. Some of us would love to forget.
Yep. I had a hard time recognizing her because she had her clothes on the whole time. But after a while, I was like, oh, yeah.
That's right. Steaming, released by New World Pictures. You can find our episode about it and learn that it's Erica's favorite movie about women hanging out in a steam bath.
Incorrect. You're going to have to make up a lie to get closer to that truth, Ryan.
I just did. I lied about it and we got closer.
Oh, yeah. Well, good job, you handsome so-and-so.
Mr. Rumsey is played by Joss Ackland, who we may remember from New World's Saint Jack, but who I can't see and not think of this.
Diplomatic immunity.
That's right, from Lethal Weapon 2, which Mark and I saw a tremendous amount as children. So,
yeah.
Mr. Rumsey, though, doesn't press charges, I guess, but he does fire Uncle Morgan from the club, leaving Queenie to beg Mr. Rumsey for his job back, and that does not end well for either party.
Well, remember, at first, he tries to, like, get her to, like, leave the cricket club, and then he tries to get her to leave the house. I have the clip for it.
I hope you realize the trouble you are in right now.
Well, as usual, you people have got everything all upside down and turned around and back to front.
Gentlemen, show Officer Riggs into the street.
And then he falls off the banister.
Yeah. That's right.
Right.
Somewhere in the middle there, he also coerces her into a affair. But then he also does fall off the staircase.
And then Riggs shoots the
ends up shooting him. Shoots him later.
No, he doesn't. No. He shoots the aquarium. Remember, that's he right. goes, eeny, meeny, my, hey, Mo! And he shoots the aquarium. That's Come right. on, guys. This is all guys, in Queenie.
You it's all in Queenie. Just go watch it. You know it. Erica, we're lying. Are we getting closer to the truth?
I don't know what we're talking about anymore.
I don't understand. Community.
It's a line he says several times in Lethal Weapon 2 as the bad guy in it. But anyway, so this whole tragedy, she's so excited. This whole tragedy forces Queenie's mother to ship Queenie to England with Uncle Morgan in tow to keep her safe. That wasn't a great plan, was it?
No. It actually worked out to be a terrible plan. She didn't go and the uncle just stayed home is a mystery.
Yeah,
I don't understand.
No clue.
I mean, the first clip we played, she's talking about, we're going to go back to England and go be with your father and we're going to go home. Incidentally, I don't understand why she says she's going to go home because she hasn't been to England. So I don't know why that's home, but I digress.
Yep.
Why didn't she take this opportunity to go with her daughter to England?
Nope. As soon as everything's like, oh God, this guy died and you could be responsible. Let's get you out of here and go with your uncle. I think somebody was like, whoo, I got some time to myself. Oh, I've been living with those two assholes for a long time. Mama needs some me time.
I've got all of these Vinegar Syndrome movies I have to watch them.
It is a lot. They keep putting out these box sets. It's a ton. And this is the 1930s, so they're sending me nothing but reels. These reels are just taking up precious space.
They're
on the shelves.
Beautifully packaged reels.
I don't know why we need a slipcover for a reel of film. It seems unnecessary. But if I don't buy it, it loses value. All right, we're leaving Erica behind here with these bits. But anyway, England was not a better setting for Mia Sara, the actress, who, by the way, did not have a great time shooting in India already, because we're talking about a young person just immediately coming from Norway. In India, she suffered from sunstroke and 106 fever and had to take 3 days off from filming. When they get to London, she apparently got sick there as well and was throwing up on set. So they had to get her into all sorts of some sort of treatment, which is essentially, she said, ended up with her just taking Excedrin and getting on with it. But in England, Queenie does get a job in one of those classic bait and switches that happens to all of us, where you go into a to be a waitress and you leave an exotic dancer. I mean, it happens. Everybody's had that happen at least once.
Maybe for you, Ryan. I mean, clearly I have a face for podcasting, so I've never left as an exotic dancer, you know, on purpose. By accident, perhaps.
On purpose. Maybe just threw in a few, just jumped up there and did a quick twirl around the dance floor. But hey, you know what? Show business is show business, and she even gets Uncle Morgan a job, so it all works out great. And it's there at the club she meets a photographer named Lucien. This is actually based on Merle Oberon's second husband, who was also named Lucien. But she divorced Alexander Korda and then married him. He's played by Gary Cady, who had previously appeared in 1985's Not Quite Paradise, released by New World Pictures.
I've seen it.
Have you?
No.
No, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen that one.
No, I've never even heard of it until now, so I don't know who that was.
We have mentioned it in passing with other cast members on other episodes. I believe in Death Before Dishonor, there's somebody that was in that that was also in Not Quite Paradise. But we have yet to even put that one up as a potential one. In 5 years, we have not been like, hey, we should get into that Not Quite Paradise. What do you think? We have not at all gone for that one. Anyway, we'll get there eventually, guys. Not Quite Paradise fans.
Oh, wow.
That box cover does not look fun.
Yeah, that DVD
cover. It looks like somebody did a weird collage.
Yeah, like they're not even lit the same. Like these are shot totally differently. They didn't even try to mix them together.
That's not good.
At Blockbuster, I would have walked right past this one and been like, no, not back.
Nope to that. That does not draw the eye. Speaking of Korda, though, that is to say, who Alexander Korda, it's not until night two of the miniseries that we meet Kirk Douglas. So if you watch night one because you were like a huge Kirk Douglas fan, like you probably were pretty bummed. Because we do not get there. You're like, well, I guess I gotta watch the next one, because shit, where the hell is Kirk Douglas? Anyway, here's how Douglas does enter the movie. He's talking about a movie he plans to direct with his friend and agent, and even though he was a producer, he's now going to direct this movie.
Mary's very enthused about it.
Your wife has more faith than you do.
I have enormous faith in you, David. You're a superb producer, but directing's another story.
I've directed before.
Two small pictures. Huh? 5 years ago, charming. But the Secret Palace is huge. I mean, it could cost $25 million. My God, that's more than Gone with the Wind.
Now, Gone with the Wind's budget was less than $4 million. Just to let you guys know. But...
jeez, embellish much? God.
This is perhaps them adjusting for inflation? I'm not 100%, but because in the movie, it drives me, we're not into things we hated, but it drives me crazy because they keep saying we need 25 million or something. They need like some exorbitant amount of money because the movie becomes expensive. And I'm like, they did not make movies that were that expensive at that time. They didn't make movies for millions of dollars. So, I mean,
well,
this is the 1930s. I know
we're not a final questions, but... did you guys also find it confusing, all the numbers that they do have flying around? It's like 20 million. No, wait, it's 4 million. No, it's 100 million. No, wait, someone has $50,000. Someone's got a $500,000. They're throwing around with these numbers. I was like, how can someone show me the ledger of this movie? Because I am confused.
Yeah, somebody crunch these motherfucking numbers immediately. Mark is furious. Someone sort out this budget and present it to Mark.
By the way, the agent there is played by Joel Grey of Cabaret fame and father of Mia Sara's Ferris Bueller co-star, Jennifer Grey.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Of course, Kirk Douglas is taken with Queenie and he makes her the lead in the movie Secret Palace, I guess. We have no idea what this movie is. They do not give us any details about what this is. Apparently, it's a big epic because they, as luck would have it, they need to take the production to India. Now, here's what Michael Korda said about this move in May of 1987. He said, quote, I don't think they left a lot out of the book, he means, but they put a lot in. They take her back to India to make a big movie. That's very exciting, but it's not in the book and was not in Meryl's life. So, okay. I thought that you had to lie in order to get to the truth, Michael, but I don't know. I'm just quoting you back to you. I'm just... I don't know.
Mikey's having trouble keeping his truth lies straight. It's a slippery slope. Slippery slope.
Once you let those truth lies slip, they become both truth and lies all at the same time.
Yep.
All right. <Yeah. clears throat> Who knew going back to India would complicate everything for Queenie? but boy, I think it.
Queenie knew. I think Queenie knew exactly.
She knew right away. She was like, ooh, that's problematic. Yeah. Because like I said earlier, her childhood bully Prunella is all grown up, but she's still trying to bring Queenie down.
Man, Prunella is like the Fred Goldman of Calcutta. I thought that one would kill, but I guess
it'll kill someone.
Oh wow. Well, cool.
Yep. Moving on. So Prunella's all grown up. She's trying to get her father's killer. And in this story of wild coincidences, Queenie meets her nemesis at the polo club.
Mm-hmm. What the hell's the matter with you? That's a damn fool thing to do.
This track is no place for beginners. If the girl can't ride, she shouldn't be here.
You arrogant twit. I'll have you thrown out of this club.
Well, that will be interesting, since I own it.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's not disturb the animals. These are film people, Miss Rumsey.
Oh, a secret palace.
I apologize. We appreciate the use of the facility.
Oh, that's all right. Actually, I don't mind films. Glad to have you. Name's Prunella Rumsey.
David Coney. This is Dawn Avalon, the star of our feature.
I say, you look familiar. I've seen you on the screen before.
Well, this is her first film.
Well, just in case you didn't understand that music cue, Prunella ain't buying it. She knows something's up.
Also, this is during a time in the movie when they're complaining about financing, that they need to finish the movie.
Right.
And they fly all the way to India. And they spend a long time in India not shooting the movie. Just chatting. Seems like they should have been like, giddy up. Let's start rolling tape as quick as we can here.
Also, that sounds good, boss. Also, what's tape? I know what all these reels are because I have all these reels of Inger syndrome sent me in these beautiful slipcases. I do not know what tape is. Now, more complications happen, of course, as we're in India. Her mom becomes her maid. The movie's running out of money, as Mark said. Prunella's hot on her trail. Lucien becomes a photographer in some films, and then he leaves, and then they don't get back together. Queenie hooks up with Kirk Douglas.
But one thing that doesn't happen that I think everyone will be pleased to know is one of the Sankara stones are not stolen, and kids are not forced into captivity at all in this movie. Unlike the Temple of Doom.
I know we're not at final questions, but what are we talking about?
Hey, Mark has seen a film that took place in India. One prevailing memory of a movie set in India. Just one. Gandhi just went right over your head. You were like, I don't know. I don't. Where's that set?
Another movie where they couldn't find an Indian actor. But
Ben Kingsley has some Indian heritage, so he... You know that Ben Kingsley's name is actually Krishna Pandit Bhanji. That's his actual name.
Sounds pretty English to me.
You know what? Honestly, if Ben Kingsley had played Queenie, he would have killed it.
Yeah.
He would have killed it. He would have been great. Yeah,
mm-hmm. It's true.
They could have just called it Kingsley.
Kingy!
Oh, two nights. Ben Kingsley as Kingly.
And also Ben's Kingly.
Oh, man. Okay.
Hey, this is Jason Kleberg from the Force 5 podcast, a show that forces a guest to come up with a movie-themed top 5 list topic, and then we reveal our picks on air. Top 5 heist films, top 5 tearjerkers, top 5 movie dogs. Every show you'll be asking yourself, what would be on my list? Guests include directors, screenwriters, actors, podcasters, musicians, authors, and even a professional wrestler. Subscribe to the Force 5 podcast, and you won't just be a listener, you'll be a list nerd. The Force 5 podcast, available wherever you're listening now.
Well, I guess it's that time, Erica.
My goodness, you look familiar. You look like things we loved and things we hated.
Let's talk about the things we loved and the things we hated about Queenie. Mark, let's start with you. What's something you loved?
You know, I thought Mia Sara did a pretty decent job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
The fact that she was coming off Apprentice to Murder to this is also perplexing, but I thought she I thought she did a really good job. If she hadn't been as good as she was in this character, it would have been a real tough watch. But
for sure.
I think that she, you know, she was interesting and carried the scenes, and she did a really good job when she's getting interrogated of being nervous, but yet being confident and finding her acting skills to try and pull herself through it. And it all played very well. So I thought she was really good.
She's no Jane Seymour, but she did all right. All right, Erica, what's something you loved?
I touched on it a little bit earlier, or maybe I didn't. Who's to say? What's the truth? What's the lie? I liked all of the early section of her life, of Queenie's life, that was all in India. I thought that was really neat. It was very beautiful looking, and it really comes through, even in a somewhat, you know, pixelated copy. It was still, you know, very beautiful looking, and I think really, really interesting. And I totally agree with Mark. I thought Mia Sara's acting was very good. I was surprised to hear she was only 19 in that, because I think playing a character that is someone who is new to acting, so you're playing someone who's learning to act, or who is like new to acting, I think that's a tough thing to do, because you can either look really silly doing it or look bad. I just think that's a really tough line to tread, and I think that she does it very well. Mm-hmm. And I like that Joel Grey was in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, oh, Joel Grey.
A part that doesn't really need to be there that much. It's a throwaway character that they give way too much to, probably because it's Joel Grey, or I don't know. But
it
he's
was
great.
A thankless character that
for sure.
You just felt for. And I was never really sure if he was on Queenie's side or not, and or if he wanted the movie to fail or not. And I don't know if that was just me adding on that layer of complexity, but I was like, I don't know what if he's going to turn out to be a bad guy at some point. So I kind of liked that.
Well, his
of
wife
him,
was,
of where
he was putting money up for the movie.
Right. Right.
So he was definitely invested in terms of her, at least, putting mm-hmm. money in. But yeah, you would think like, oh, is he going to go wrong? Plus, at one point, Kirk Douglas slaps him in the face.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, sorry, I took that a little far. And I'm like, this is your best friend.
Yeah.
You're my best friend and agent, and I'm going to slap you in your face. Like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
He not only slaps him, he backhands him, which is the most insulting way to hit a man. I don't need to say anything more about that.
Yeah, all right. All right. Well, I loved, speaking of actors, I loved Topol, the actor best known for playing Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof. He was played Queenie's boss at the strip club and later her manager. And he has to kind of tread this weird line because he has to play a guy that you believe is okay with, as he says in the movie, exploiting women. So he's that kind of person who's going to exploit women and make money and has a strip club, but also someone that Queenie can trust. He's the first guy that she explains her secret to. So he's got to play both of those things. Mm-hmm. And that's tricky, especially in this movie. I don't think anyone has that much going on character wise. So maybe Queenie, but that's about it. And I think he did a very good job. And I thought he was really good in this. That's what I agreed.
He's good. He's really good. Yeah. I mean, he's obviously my number three since I didn't even bring his name up, but you know, he does a good job, I guess. So throw him
a good
bone
job
there.
I mean, you know, yes, you guys already talked about Mia Sara, so and I actually like Kirk Douglas. I thought that was pretty good in this too.
Yeah, but I mean, at that point, he had to be good in it. Like, come on, Kirk.
Yeah, he's been doing this for a long time. If he hadn't figured it out by now. Yeah. All right, let's switch to things we hated. Mark, what did you hate?
I hated the way that Topol smoked his cigars. He's puffing on those things way too fast.
Yeah.
When you smoke a cigar, you got to puff like every 45 seconds. You got to roll it, take your time, maybe do a little reverse inhale to get the flavors to come through. And a cigar should take 45 minutes to an hour and a half, depending on the size. He is just puffing away at that thing. That thing's got to be so hot that it is not even enjoyable anymore. And I found it annoying. Like, this is obviously someone that's never smoked a cigar. So they're just like, I'll just keep hitting this thing. I'm just keep hitting it. Every time I stop talking, I'll just keep puffing on it, puffing on it, puffing on it. I was like, stop it. You are ruining what could be a very nice, enjoyable experience. Just chill out, relax, enjoy it.
Erica, what is something you hated?
I really hated the pacing of the second half. It really slows down. And there's so much of just watching the movie being made that I think it doesn't really add that much to it, other than, I guess, it looking kind of neat or kind of seeing how it's done. But I don't think it, I think it actually kind of slowed down the tension of the story. It didn't add to the drama. It was like, oh, come on, get to it. Like,
get to it. Just
get to it. So that sort of second volume or, you know, second half pacing, it was kind of a bummer because to that point, I was really into it. The only other thing I hated, and if you haven't watched it and you want to watch, now's your time to push pause and come on back, was the ending. Hated the ending.
Yeah.
For me personally, it didn't have the payoff, I guess maybe that was intended.
Right.
Of Don Avalon coming up and revealing that she's...
The film you're about to see tonight, I play an English woman. That's not really me. I wanted you all to know that. Because I'm very proud of where I came from. And who I am.
Then descends from the staircase to reignite the flame with Lucien, who's the only person clapping in the audience. And then they just make out. And there's a big old make out while everyone just stands around them and claps. That's the end? That's how you're going to end all this?
I mean, when you have a big ending speech, which is about, you know what? I'm not going to lie anymore. I'm going to tell you that I'm also half Indian. And this is my mom, who's a white woman, playing an Indian woman. It's like, and I'm also just Italian and American. It cuts a lot of that, like, of you being like, yeah, she's embraced her truth. It's like, yeah, I mean,
but if the truth is a lie, which is the truth and also a lie, then you're fine. But
that's right. I guess it did work.
But Erica, to your point, another thing I hated, I think you'll agree with me on this, I hated the kissing scenes between Lucien and Queenie because they are aggressively, angrily kissing each other. Just like, I am going to fuck your mouth off when I kiss you.
It just looked like he was so thirsty that he was on the brink of... He was on the brink of complete dehydration, and her mouth was the last fountain, the last water fountain on earth. And he was putting his whole mouth over it.
His whole mouth on it. I was like, I hope this isn't one of the days she was throwing up on set, because my God, dude, you went after it. You went after it.
I mean, I think, I think I would have liked to have that payoff be a bit more and see... Even if it would have just been, you know, and this is one of my least favorite things, but like story at the end, like words on the screen of Dawn / Queenie went on to star in 20 more films, something else, because it just, to me, tell me if you feel differently, she hid who she was out of self-preservation. It wasn't that she wasn't proud to be half Indian or that she didn't like it. Or that she didn't like India, or that she didn't like her family. She had to hide that to stay alive and to get work and to get jobs. Mm-hmm. Because if she would have revealed that, she couldn't have gotten all those things. So, for me, it just didn't have the payoff. I guess I wanted more to come out of that. Like, because she embraced that truth, she continued on this long, flourishing career. I don't know. It just didn't, for me, it didn't have, I think, the big payoff that it was supposed to.
Yep.
Maybe that's just me. I don't know, listeners. Write in and tell me if you feel differently after you watch it. But it just didn't feel, it wasn't a satisfying ending for me. And then watching him just suck that water fountain dry, I was just like, God, this is it?
Yeah, it's a little too pat, that ending, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just to go back, I hated the movie budget issues. Also, I mean, I hated all that. That was just like, who cares? The movie's called Queenie. Who gives a shit? But like, how are we going to afford this movie? Like, I don't know. And I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Yep. Like, this is nothing about Queenie's life. And it seemed like they were like, well, we got to make this role juicy for Kirk Douglas. And I can understand that. But like, it's just like, you just don't care. I mean, I'm like, why are we suddenly all like, man, I really hope this character we have met literally hours into this movie. I hope this all works out for this dude. And then Martin Balsam, who's the first guy mentioned in the trailer, number one on the trailer, marquee. Well, I hope you're ready to watch him in the 0 hour of this fucking movie, because he does not show up to the like last half hour as a guy who just shows up and is like, hey, you need money? I'll pay you a little money. And then he's like, congrats on the movie, everyone. That's Martin Balsam's role. It's like, why? Right. Yeah, what a waste.
Mm-hmm.
Have Joel Grey just be like, you know what? My wife and I decided we're going to come in and we're going to make... Because he's there. Make him important. Make him even more important to the whole thing.
That's a really good point. They could have built a lot more tension, because I think the other thing that compounds the problem is at no point do you feel like the movie's actually going to be canceled.
Right. Of course not.
Right.
Now, if he was like, my wife has fronted all the money, and now they keep covering how the marriage isn't going well and he's getting calls from his wife, which is another thing we don't care about. Nobody cares.
Yeah.
We never see this character. And so we only hear about them having calls and how he's having to have these tough calls with his wife. Now, if those tough calls were because they're starting to run over budget and she is getting concerned because she has no more money, and he's really putting pressure on Kirk Douglas's character, like, we have to get this done. You would actually have more reason to care about that subplot.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And you don't. So it's like,
again, miniseries is just a stretched out hour and 40 minute movie.
And Martin Balsam coming in as a deus ex machina, just being like, here's the money you needed. Let's keep rolling. Like, it's like, well, then what was the point of all of it? It's just, anyway, let's get to our favorite scene. Mark, what was your favorite scene?
My favorite scene is when Queenie and her uncle go to the movie theater and they are delicately whispering and everyone around them is like, shh, hey, shut keep it down. Up. Shh, shut up. And I just kept laughing because I'm thinking, these fucking people would lose their mind if they went to a movie theater today with people like FaceTiming during the movie and answering texts. Mm-hmm. I mean, Queenie and her uncle are talking like, hey, so what are we going to do? Like so quiet. Mm-hmm. And they are not putting up with it. These people would, I mean, there would be violence in the theater if they went to a movie theater today.
Yeah. Right. Right.
So true.
Erica, what was your favorite scene?
My favorite scene was between Prunella and her mom, where her mom basically tells her to stop the investigation.
You mean so your dirty laundry doesn't have to hang out and dry?
No, Prunella. For your own good. I am afraid that if you go on and on with this damned investigation, you are going to find out things about dear Daddy that you are not prepared to know.
My father was the kindest man in the whole world.
And what do you know about the world?
I really loved that scene. I thought it was really well done, and I thought it was really important for the character of Mrs. Rumsey, because you don't see much of her. And right, to just see that side of it, like, leave this girl alone and let it go. And, you know, your dad wasn't a great guy. Like, she knew what he was up to. And she just wants this done and wants to move on. And so it really shows you that it really is truly Prunella who just can't get over this and can't let it go. And she is like her dad. And she is sort of ruthless and vengeful and mean and cruel. She took all those terrible characteristics of him. So that was my favorite scene. I thought that was a really good one.
It was really good. That was a really great scene.
Yeah,
I liked that too.
My favorite scene is the scene where Kirk Douglas breaks up with Queenie and gives her all the letters that he never received. She never received from Lucien, and then just sits down on a park bench and just dies. All right.
Yeah.
And I know that's not funny per se, or certainly probably doesn't sound funny, but like, it is so ludicrous that is this what happens when you get older? You're like, I can feel it. Tonight's the night. This is it. I'm going out. Like, I mean, well, I know he'd had heart trouble. I get that. But like, he somehow is just like, I'm going to give you all these letters because I know I'm dying this evening. How on earth? That is insane.
I think what makes it funny is that the scene transition is a newspaper article about his death, and it's a picture of him dead on the bench. So for me, I was like, somebody with a camera rolled up and saw him dead there and was like, snap. Like,
this is going on the front page.
Yeah, I was like, that's ridiculous. Like,
it's so ridiculous. It is just, it's ludicrous. And it's so, like, in a movie of almost 4 hours of stuff, they had to squeeze this ending in? I don't, why on earth do we have to, like, quickly just throw this little ending together? I don't know. It's
a Game of Thrones theory. They're like, wait a minute, we got to wrap this all up really quick.
Quickly,
I know we've been working to this big crescendo for, I don't know, 5 years, but we're going to just wrap this up in one episode.
Wrap it up
just
fast.
Everything gets tied up. Done.
All right, very quick final questions. I found this out very late in this process, but and it's on the Wikipedia page for Sarah Miles, but apparently Sarah Miles for years has drank her own urine for health reasons.
What?
Yep. It's on her Wikipedia page, and I don't know the validity of this. I don't know what for.
I'm worried about when this turns into a question.
Well, when you see her and rewatch Steaming or whatever you see her in next, will that be something you think of?
Yeah, that's it. She's a pee-pee drinker now. That's...
Because that's how I now will look at her and go, she drinks her own pee and did so for years and years. That's all I'll think of now.
What are the health reasons?
I don't know.
I thought your pee was like your waste.
If the doctor's like, look, you probably have another 30, 40 years left, but you're probably going to have to drink your pee every day. I'll be like, well, it's been a great ride, doc. It's been good.
Yeah. What are the other options? I mean,
it defies logic that your body is doing everything in its power to remove this liquid. And then you're like, fuck you, body.
I got to get back in there. It's like you hate your own body. You're like, fuck you, body.
I don't trust you. I don't believe you.
Are you sure you got all the nutrients out of that?
Look, I'm not a doctor anymore, but I just really quickly Googled health reasons to drinking urine. And the first thing that came up that's highlighted says there are no health benefits to ingesting urine. And then it says immediately under that, any other drink involves fewer health risks than ingesting urine. Any other drink. You want a Monster Energy? No problem. Please do.
Drink all the Mountain Dew. Drink all of it. Drink it all. Every last ounce is better for you than your own piss. I don't know. I needed some other people to share in that gross fact that won't leave my brain now.
So it really changes steaming for me.
Thank you, and I'm sorry. All right.
It's not so much that it's going to take it off my top five, but it just changes some of my thoughts about steaming.
It was in your top five for a while. That's crazy. All right. Here's something that Mia Sara told the LA Times in May 1987. She's talking about the book itself of Queenie. She says, quote, "It's a great part, all right, but I still think it was a shabby thing to do writing that book. It doesn't paint a very attractive picture of the woman." Agree or disagree?
I didn't read the book, so I don't know.
Yeah, same. I didn't read the book either. And also, I thought Mia Sara didn't read the book.
She didn't. So
we can just comment on stuff we haven't read or seen? The next thing up on the lineup, I'm not watching it, but I have a lot of things to say about it.
That would be wild if one of us secretly didn't watch the movie we're supposed to talk about and then just had...
I volunteer as tribute. Pick me, please.
Are you saying this has turned into Hunger Games?
Going into some research, Highgate Pictures picked up the book of Queenie for a miniseries adaptation in November of 1984, before it was even published. It was advertised that they were going to make Queenie and also a book called Personal Effects, which was written by Rex Reed, but was a fictional book.
Did that get made?
The book did get published in the fall of 1985. The movie never got made. And boy, did I try to look it up, because I was excited if it did. The movie, Queenie, was made for $12 million, according to an article I found. It says, the $12 million production on which New World Television will break even only with extensive foreign sales, being filmed in England in Jaipur, India. So... $12 million they spent on this. That's wild. The first part of Queenie aired on May 10th, 1987 on ABC against the Louis Gossett Jr. TV movie A Gathering of Old Men on CBS, which by title alone sounds like CBS calling itself out. Then
didn't need Louis Gossett Jr. to do that.
Yeah. Even in the late 80s, CBS is like, I don't know, old dudes watch our shit. That's it. Then on NBC, another miniseries, Hands of a Stranger, starring Armand Asante, Beverly D'Angelo, and a young Ben Affleck, was what was airing against the very first night. Part two would air the next night. And this time for 3 hours instead of two. Or actually, instead of 1.5, I think. And at least in L.A., in Los Angeles, on what was just becoming a Fox channel, because this is 1987, up against it was Battle Beyond the Stars from New World Pictures, was what aired on a newly, freshly minted Fox channel.
Nice choice. Good choice for them.
A lot of the reviews were pretty positive. I would say it's a little bit more mixed. But Newsday said this. Queenie is one of the better made trashy miniseries, beautifully photographed by Tony Immy on location in Jaipur, India and London. I'd recommend that anyone taking the pledge to say no to trash wait until Tuesday. Sunday and Monday is when it aired. Talking about November. I thought that was perfect. The New York Times, however, was less courteous, saying, why, for instance, when so many Indian actors have excelled in such productions as A Passage to India and The Jewel and the Crown, do we still have to find Indian characters played by British actors using dark makeup and a sing-song accent?
That sort of changes my theory. So you're saying there were
Indian actors? Wild. Here are the ratings. The ratings for part one that aired on a Sunday night. Queenie lands at number 37 in front of Magnum P.I. at number 38, but following Stingray on NBC at number 36.
Stingray.
That stings.
That's rough. By the way, yeah. A Gathering of Old Men. Remember that old movie? That was number 10 for the week. On CBS.
Well, that's the draw that Louis Gossett Jr. had back then.
Yeah, well, and just saying, oh, old men? It's about old men and CBS? I ain't missing this. By the way, Hands of a Stranger Part 1 also outperformed Queenie. That was at number 27.
What was number 1?
Number 1 was a Cheers, which was the season finale.
Oh, yeah.
When Diane left.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was a big one.
So
it
was her last episode. So that was number one. Yeah. For part two, that's Monday. So the next week, the Nielsen ratings, Queenie was number 29.
Okay.
In front of Ellie Law at number 30, but following Head of the Class at number 28.
Well, Head of the Class was really good. That was a good show.
That's tough stuff. It was also, by the way, the second night, it was going up against a CBS Tuesday movie called Ghost of a Chance, which did perform at number 24. So it did go ahead of it. And again, Hands of a Stranger, part two, also airing that Monday. That was up to number 17. So unfortunately, that one was a little bit more successful. But how does this end up as a New World movie? Very quickly, just to say, that's because New World had bought Highgate Pictures, and Highgate Pictures was the one that optioned the book. In February 1986, a Los Angeles Times article says New World Pictures agreed to acquire a controlling interest in New York-based Learning Corporation of America, which we have been hearing a lot about, and Highgate Pictures. They were a combined company, Highgate Pictures and Learning Corporation of America. Of course, in our live episode from last month, we did one of our very first Learning Corporation of America episodes, where we talked about a video about keeping kids safe that was hosted by Gary Coleman, and it's called For Safety's Sake. But anyway, they bought up the majority of the stock for Highgate and Learning Corporation of America. That's how they were expanding themselves. And this is unplanned, but I just recently got a billboard from 1986, August, which they sort of talk about the LCA. Look at this big ad of Learning Corporation of America. And they talk about the acquisition of Highgate and also Film Dallas and congratulate New World Pictures. A lot of articles, lots of good stuff that's going to come out of this billboard. But anyway... Nice. So Queenie was announced then as a New World television project in June, just a couple months later, June of 1986. It was announced by John Feltheimer, who was the executive vice president at the time of New World Television. He is now in charge of Lionsgate, so he is still in the biz. It's released on VHS, Queenie, in the UK on September 28th, 1987. It does not appear in U.S. rental stores until June of 1989, along with a release of a New World TV series, Crime Story, and Party Incorporated, which we talked about in September Part 2.
Sure did.
That one's fighting for that top five. It is fighting its way.
Mm-hmm. And when I ripped the first tape of Queenie, the preview before it is Under the Boardwalk, which, of course, is the last movie they put out theatrically. So it makes sense that that would be in front of Queenie because it's 1989. And at that time, they had to be like, what do we have on the shelves? Push it. Let's go. It's June 1989. Let's get it all out there. Whatever we got left, let's get it out there. Party Incorporated, you're out. You're hitting shelves. Mm-hmm. And that's it. That is Queenie. And the end. Queenie! And the end of November!
No!
November. No.
Where you also got, in this episode, a sneak preview of what we're going to be talking about in the next November. But we hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, you can want to catch up with all our other episodes for November, or our previous Robotober, or our Sextember Part 2, or any of the other episodes that we've done, and all our many theme months. You can go to our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com. You can find our t-shirts, articles, episodes, our socials. It's all there. It's all in one place. It's a website. You know what it is. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast, a part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.